Today is Monday, May 25th, 2026. This is your geopolitics briefing for Briefing Desk. In the next 29 to 32 minutes, we'll cover the Russia-Ukraine war entering a phase of attritional stalemate, with Russian casualty figures now exceeding recruitment capacity for 5 consecutive months, alongside mounting pressure inside the Kremlin, a suspended U.S. diplomatic track, and warnings from European energy analysts that EU gas storage is dangerously below seasonal norms heading into winter. Let's start on the battlefield, in eastern Ukraine, where the picture remains contested, but the underlying arithmetic is increasingly difficult for Moscow. Ukrainian Armed Forces Commander-in-Chief Oleksandr Sirsky claimed that during one 24-hour period, Ukrainian forces launched more attacks than Russian forces, a claimed first in the war, according to reporting from WarrenPolitics24. That's a striking assertion, and it's worth holding it alongside a more cautious reading offered by an independent analyst cited in the same transcript. That analyst noted that gray zones contested terrain without permanent Ukrainian defensive positions continue expanding westward along multiple axes. The areas named include the Turetsk and Chasiv Yar corridor, areas east of Slovyansk, and adjacent villages. One Ukrainian stronghold northwest of Bakhmut was assessed as approximately 90% under Russian control, according to the Deep State Map, a Ukrainian open-source tracking resource. So on the ground, the picture is genuinely mixed. But at the strategic level, retired U.S. Army Lieutenant General Ben Hodges offered a more definitive verdict. Speaking on the Decoding Geopolitics podcast, hosted by Dominic Prezel in early May of this year, Hodges said, and I'll quote him directly, "It's clear that the momentum has shifted to the advantage of Ukraine. There's no way that Russia can actually defeat Ukraine." He cited 5 converging factors to support that assessment. The first and arguably most significant is this: Russian casualties have now exceeded Russia's recruitment capacity, and that's been true for 5 consecutive months. The numbers here deserve careful attention. Investigative outlets Medusa and Media Zona, working in collaboration with the BBC Russian service, announced on May 9th of this year that approximately 352,000 Russian soldiers had been killed between the war's start and the end of 2025. That figure comes from cross-referencing social media posts and official probate records. The BBC Russian service alone constructed a database of approximately 218,000 confirmed names through that methodology. Separately, the Center for Strategic and International Studies estimated in January that approximately 325,000 Russian soldiers and 140,000 Ukrainians had been killed by the end of 2025. Building on that, Ukraine's unmanned systems forces provided a particularly telling set of figures. Between December 2025 and April 2026, Russia recruited approximately 148,400 personnel. In that same period, Russia suffered 156,735 confirmed casualties, with losses of approximately 34,000 in each of March and April alone. 5 consecutive months in which losses outpaced recruitment. That's the core of Hodges's argument. The Russian military's capacity to regenerate combat power is structurally compromised. For context on where Ukrainian commanders hope to push that dynamic, Sirsky's office has set a target of eliminating up to 50,000 Russian troops per month by the end of 2026. The transcript is careful to characterize this as an objective, not an achieved rate. But the ambition reflects the scale of attrition Ukraine is attempting to sustain. Zelensky's office separately cited a briefing from Sirsky claiming that Russian forces have sustained over 145,000 personnel losses since the beginning of 2026, with nearly 86,000 recorded as killed in action, more than 59,000 as severely wounded, and more than 800 servicemen entering the prisoner exchange fund. These figures, the transcript notes, are not independently corroborated. The second major factor Hodges cited is Russian drone corridor strategy, and it tells us something important about how Moscow is trying to adapt. Forbes, as cited in WarrenPolitics24, reported that Russian operational doctrine has increasingly centered on establishing what are described as drone corridors, pathways through contested terrain where unmanned aerial vehicles operate in sufficient concentration to dominate local airspace. The intent is to convert those corridors into transit routes for ground troops. The same analysis identified a unit called Rubicon as having repositioned its drone operators to locations 50 to 100 kilometers behind the front line, reducing their exposure to Ukrainian countermeasures. It's a doctrine of layered UAV control rather than direct infantry assault, an adaptation to Ukrainian defenses. The third factor is Ukraine's own long-range strike capability, which Hodges described as having reached a strategically significant threshold. He stated that Ukraine now has enough precision long-range weapons that can strike refineries over 1,000 kilometers away, deep inside Russia. The strategic rationale, as Hodges framed it, is not just military, it's economic. Degrading Russia's oil and gas export infrastructure directly limits the revenue Moscow relies on to fund the war through sales to India and China. The transcript from the military show names the Flamingo and Long Neptune missiles as examples of Ukrainian long-range strike systems now in production or deployment. And Hodges added that Ukraine's domestic defense industry has grown to the point where other countries are placing orders for Ukrainian drones and systems, a meaningful signal of confidence in the industry's output. Those battlefield dynamics sit alongside a second major story, what's happening inside Russia itself, and specifically inside the Kremlin. A convergence of reporting from multiple sources in late May portrays the Russian leadership as operating under heightened internal stress. Let's work through the specific signals. Start with the approval rating numbers. The Russian Public Opinion Research Center failed to publish Putin's weekly approval figure on May 1st, breaking its standard Friday release cycle, according to War and Politics 24. Then the Public Opinion Foundation separately recorded a 3 percentage point single-week decline in Putin's approval rating, bringing it to 73%. That is described as the lowest level since February 2022, the month the full-scale invasion began. More interesting than the number itself is what followed. On May 15th, the Russian Public Opinion Research Center announced a change in survey methodology. It is now adding door-to-door household visits to what had been a telephone-only survey format. The stated reason: growing public distrust of phone conversations, anti-spam filters, and telephone fraud. The transcript notes, carefully, that it does not include independent assessment of whether this represents a genuine methodological improvement or an effort to manage how the data looks going forward. Building on that, consider Putin's public visibility. The Telegram channel Ferry Daily, cited in War and Politics 24, reported that from January through March of this year, Putin reduced his public appearances by nearly 25% compared to the same period in 2025. And the May 9th Victory Day parade in Moscow lasted 45 minutes, with heavy armored vehicles and missile systems notably absent from the display. The Associated Press, per the same transcript, linked the absence of heavy military equipment and communication disruptions during the parade to growing tensions within Russia. Opposition figure Mikhail Khodorkovsky, quoted in the transcript, described Putin as an aging and frightened dictator. Then there is the coup question, which adds a different dimension entirely. Investigative outlet Vozhny published what it described as a European intelligence assessment, stating that since early March of this year, the Kremlin has faced growing concern about a conspiracy or coup attempt. CNN highlighted that Sergei Shoigu, formerly defense minister, now Security Council secretary since 2024, was among the figures associated with coup-related risks in the document. The assessment reportedly claimed that the arrest of Ruslan Salikov, described as Shoigu's former deputy, was viewed inside elite circles as a violation of an unwritten agreement among Russia's powerful. The security measures described in this document are, to put it plainly, extraordinary in their domestic reach. They include surveillance installation inside the homes of Putin's inner circle, restrictions on public transportation for cooks, guards, and photographers, double screening for visitors, the use of phones without internet access, and a reported halt to Moscow region residence visits. A current FSB officer cited by Vozhny said his unit faced increasing difficulty obtaining wiretap authorizations, with resources redirected toward monitoring government institutions rather than external threats. That is a significant signal of where the Kremlin's threat perception is focused right now. On the subject of image management, which runs alongside all of this, in early May, the Kremlin released footage of Putin meeting a former school teacher named Vera Gurovich at a hotel on Arbat Street in Moscow. Political analyst Stanislav Belotsky counted at least 7 public meetings between Putin and Gurovich over the past 26 years. Political scientist Dmitry Oreshkin, speaking on the YouTube channel Migranogram, described the footage as part of a repeating, manufactured affections cycle. Ferry Daily observed that since Putin's divorce in 2013, the Kremlin has ceased publicly showing Putin with children, grandchildren, or personal life details, with Gurovich serving as virtually the only pre-ruling era figure to appear regularly in official footage. The strategic question this all raises is whether Russia can sustain its current posture. The independent analyst, cited by Warren Politics 24, laid out 2 principal scenarios for what comes after stalemate. The first is a ceasefire or frozen conflict, which Zelensky has proposed for more than a year, and which the EU and United States have also pursued. The second is a new forced mobilization. The 2022 mobilization of 250,000 personnel is cited as a precedent that contributed to subsequent Russian territorial gains in the Donbas. Analyst Neil Davis, cited in a separate Warren Politics 24 report, assessed that the Kremlin will, almost certainly, be forced to launch a second partial mobilization within the next 12 months to sustain frontline positions. Zelensky was also quoted stating that Russia currently lacks the capacity for further covert mobilization, with Russian war bloggers assessed as agreeing that current methods are no longer effective. The logic of the mobilization trap is becoming harder for Moscow to escape. On the diplomatic front, the picture this week was defined by a notable U.S. withdrawal from active mediation. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio publicly confirmed the suspension of U.S.-mediated trilateral talks between Russia and Ukraine. He stated that Washington engaged because it was assessed to be, in his words, the only one that the Russians and the Ukrainians would talk to. But he characterized the talks as not fruitful and said the United States is not interested in getting involved in an endless cycle of meetings that lead to nothing. Rubio maintained that the war can only end with a negotiated settlement, while assessing that no other party is currently positioned to assume a mediating role. He also disputed, as not true, reports that Washington had pressured Ukraine into specific negotiating positions. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov offered Moscow's framing in parallel remarks. He stated that Russia had proposed mutual security treaty obligations to NATO and the United States on multiple occasions, citing 2028, December 2021, and January 2022 as specific instances. Lavrov said both Brussels and Washington declined legally binding security guarantees to non-NATO members and described Russia's military operation as inevitable. The European governments named in the transcript do not dispute or confirm Lavrov's account in the available sourcing. Bloomberg, cited by Warren Politics 24, reported that the front line has stabilized and that Ukraine and its allies assess Russia's invasion is exhausting itself. Unnamed sources in the same transcript indicated a faction of senior Kremlin officials has acknowledged the war has reached a dead end, with no safe exit strategy for the regime. Putin, per these sources, seeks to end the war by year's end, but only on terms including total control over the Donbas and a broad security agreement with Europe, conditions that remain far outside what Kyiv or its allies have indicated they would accept. With direct mediation suspended, attention is shifting to the NATO summit in Ankara, Turkey, scheduled for July. Rubio stated, per The Guardian, as cited in Warren Politics 24, that the central topic at that summit will be President Trump's disappointment with the alliance's response to U.S. operations in the Middle East. On the deployment of 5,000 U.S. troops to Poland, Rubio characterized the move as routine force rotation rather than political signaling. On other diplomatic threads, The French Minister of Europe and Foreign Affairs stated that Paris is maintaining a permanent diplomatic channel with Beijing to urge China to use its relationship with Moscow to press for an end to Russia's aggression. The minister described the Russia-China relationship as extremely distorted and unbalanced following Russia's invasion. And separately, Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orbán stated Hungary does not plan to send soldiers to Ukraine and described the 1994 Budapest Memorandum as having failed to protect Ukrainian territorial integrity. The transcript from the military show noted that Orbán, previously described as having delayed a 90 billion euro loan to Ukraine, has since lost power, with a more pro-European prime minister having taken his place, and the loan now described as flowing to Ukraine. The transcript does not name Orbán's successor or specify a disbursement date. On nuclear posture, Putin stated Russia plans to continue equipping its strategic missile forces with new systems, including stationary and mobile variants, and referenced a recent test of the Sarmat intercontinental ballistic missile, characterized by Moscow as capable of overcoming, in Putin's framing, all modern and promising missile defense systems. Russia also announced planned joint exercises, including Interaction 2026 and Indestructible Brotherhood 2026 with CISTO partners, and the bilateral Union Shield 2027 exercise with Belarus. Now let's move to a structural story that deserves more attention than it typically receives in day-to-day coverage of the Russia-Ukraine conflict, and that's the accelerating demographic and economic collapse of Russia's Far Eastern Federal District. The scale here is worth sitting with. The district encompasses 40% of Russia's total territory, but as of 2025, it held an estimated 7.86 million residents, roughly 5% of Russia's national population. To understand the trajectory, the 1989 Soviet census recorded approximately 10.35 million people in the equivalent area. When Putin came to power, the figure was approximately 8.8 million. That's a population loss of approximately 25% over 35 years. And the sub-regional declines are more severe than the aggregate suggests. Chukotka has lost 68% of its population since 1991. Magadan Oblast has lost 63.6%. Kamchatka, 34.6%. Some projections cited in the military show's reporting forecast a further 8% decline by 2033, described as three times earlier official estimates. The economic incentive structure that historically anchored the population has eroded. Soviet-era wages in the region ran 50% to twice the national average. By the late 2010s, that premium had narrowed to approximately 18%, per the cited reporting. Meanwhile, cost of living remains 25 to 30% higher than Western Russia in cities like Khabarovsk and Vladivostok, 40 to 60% higher in Kamchatka and Sakhalin, and 80 to 100% higher in Chukotka. The district's poverty rate stands at 15.7% compared to 12.6% nationally, and life expectancy lags 2 to 3 years behind the national average. Moscow has tried repeatedly to reverse this. Development initiatives were revised in 1996, 2002, and again in 2015, with tools including territories of advanced development, a free port designation for Vladivostok, free land grants, and subsidized airfares. None have reversed the trend. The Economic Research Institute of the Russian Academy of Sciences published findings in 2021, concluding that the development model no longer functions. A plan announced in late 2023 to build 1,000 aircraft for domestic and international flights by 2030, produce 13 aircraft by 2025 before being shelved. The 2022 invasion of Ukraine has accelerated all of this, diverting resources, mobilizing working-age men disproportionately from already labor-scarce communities, and stalling infrastructure projects including rail expansion discussed as recently as 2023. Into this vacuum, Chinese economic presence has expanded rapidly. By 2025, Chinese investment in the district is projected to approach 1 trillion rubles, approximately $13.5 billion, according to the military show's cited reporting. Trade between Khabarovsk territory and China grew by 5.5 million tons in 2024, then surged a further 36% in the first 6 months of 2025 alone. An estimated 500,000 Chinese citizens now reside between Vladivostok and the Urals, facilitated by visa-free arrangements and preferential access to Russian economic zones. Ukraine's Foreign Intelligence Service is cited as reporting the formation of enclaves in several far eastern cities where Russians are, in the service's phrasing, practically absent from the workforce. North Korean labor is supplementing that picture. Over 15,000 North Korean workers officially arrived in Russia in 2024 and early 2025, with most deployed in the Far East. Unofficial estimates place the figure closer to 50,000 by end 2025. Russian companies have submitted requests for an additional 153,000 North Korean labor contracts. Workers reportedly operate under conditions including 18-hour shifts and 2 days off per year, with wage differentials directed to Pyongyang as a source of hard currency for the Kim Jong-un regime. The demographic and economic erosion of Russia's Far East is, in effect, being filled by actors whose long-term interests may diverge sharply from Moscow's. In the Indo-Pacific, two separate stories deserve attention this week: U.S.-India relations following Secretary Rubio's visit, and Taiwan's public assessment of Chinese military pressure. Rubio arrived in India for a 3-day official visit, described in StratNews Global's reporting as his first to the country. His itinerary included Kolkata, where he visited the Missionaries of Charity, and New Delhi, for a meeting with Prime Minister Narendra Modi. A bilateral meeting with External Affairs Minister S. Jaishankar is scheduled for Sunday, and a Quad Foreign Ministers meeting involving the United States, India, Australia, and Japan is scheduled for Tuesday. India's Ministry of External Affairs confirmed that India will host the Quad Summit this year. India had been scheduled to host in the prior year, but did not, with StratNews Global attributing this in part to the brief armed conflict with Pakistan, referred to as Operation Sindoor, that followed a terrorist attack in Kashmir. A notable diplomatic friction has emerged around that conflict and Washington's role in it. President Trump has publicly claimed credit for preventing a war between India and Pakistan, a position Pakistan has endorsed. India, however, has declined to formally accept that a U.S. mediating role was played, though Indian officials have expressed gratitude for U.S. engagement. The gap in framing matters. India's strategic culture places significant weight on autonomy in its bilateral relationships, and publicly crediting Washington with conflict resolution carries domestic political costs in New Delhi that the Indian government appears unwilling to absorb. On trade, an interim U.S.-India agreement has been signed, described as covering limited, lower-priority items, rather than constituting a comprehensive free trade agreement. A U.S. court ruling that certain U.S. tariffs are illegal has introduced uncertainty over whether even this partial agreement will take effect. The transcript does not specify which court or the ruling date. Rubio extended a White House invitation to Modi from President Trump without specifying a date. On Taiwan, Kulas Utaka, former spokesperson for the Office of the President of Taiwan, speaking in Kyiv during a visit that included the Lviv Media Forum, offered a striking quantification of Chinese military pressure. Chinese fighter jets crossed the median line of the Taiwan Strait more than 5,000 times in 2025, per War and Politics 24. Chinese warships conducted patrols around Taiwan, and China carried out unannounced blockade military drills without prior notification. Utaka noted that approximately 90% of Taiwan's energy is imported, characterizing this as a critical vulnerability in the context of Chinese military encirclement. If China were to enforce a naval blockade, Taiwan's energy supply becomes a pressure point within days, not months. On U.S.-Taiwan arms, Utaka cited the 1979 Taiwan Relations Act and Reagan's 1982 Six Assurances, both of which, Utaka stated, require the United States to refrain from consulting Beijing prior to arms provision. Utaka said Trump approved approximately $14 billion in arms sales to Taiwan, but subsequently delayed delivery. When pressed on the delay, Trump indicated he would discuss the matter with Xi Jinping, which Utaka characterized as a risk that Taiwan could become a bargaining chip in U.S.-China negotiations. For 2026, Utaka noted the Chinese aircraft crossing activity has decreased, offering his own assessment that this may reflect a Chinese preference not to antagonize Washington during ongoing diplomatic engagement. Both Taiwan and Ukraine, Utaka argued, face parallel structural threats, adversaries asserting territorial claims through information operations backed by nuclear deterrence, while relying on U.S. defense assistance and intelligence support. It's a framing that connects the two conflicts in a way that is becoming more common in European and Indo-Pacific diplomatic circles. The final major story this week is European energy security, and it connects directly back to the Ukraine war in ways that are not always made explicit in coverage of either topic. Analysts at Norwegian energy company Equinor warned, via Reuters, as cited in War and Politics 24, that EU gas storage facilities are currently filled to just over 35%. The seasonal norm for this time of year is approximately 50%. That 15 percentage point gap is not academic. It directly affects Europe's ability to build the reserves needed to get through the 2026 to 2027 winter without either rationing or a price shock. Equinor modeled three scenarios, contingent on developments at the Strait of Hormuz. The transcript does not specify the precise nature or date of the reference disruption, but the implications Equinor drew are clear. If the disruption ends quickly, analysts projected a storage fill level of approximately 75% by October to early December. Achievable, but tight. If disruptions persist for 1 to 3 months, the situation for European gas supply could become critical. In the worst-case scenario, Europe would be forced to compete directly with Asia for limited global liquefied natural gas volumes, triggering significant price spikes and what Equinor described as mandatory consumption cuts for European heavy industry. The analysts noted that storage entered the current period at a relatively high baseline, which provides a modest buffer against near-term shocks, but that buffer is limited, and each week of Hormuz disruption narrows the margin. This energy vulnerability intersects with the Russia-Ukraine conflict in a specific way. Hodges, on the Decoding Geopolitics podcast, described Ukrainian strikes on Russian oil infrastructure as part of a coherent theory of victory. If the Ukrainians are able to continue doing this, it really becomes difficult for Russia to pay for this war going forward. The French Minister of Foreign Affairs, per War and Politics 24, framed France's engagement with China through the lens of the French G7 presidency, which focuses on overcoming global economic imbalances. The suggestion in that framing is that European energy vulnerability and war financing dynamics are being addressed as a single integrated policy challenge, not as separate issues. We'll close with a historical note that's generating renewed attention in the context of the current war. Journalist and historian David Satter identified in a War and Politics 24 transcript as a former Moscow correspondent, gave an extended interview revisiting the series of apartment building bombings that took place in Russia in the fall of 1999. Satter stated those bombings killed nearly 300 people and, in his assessment, were orchestrated by the FSB as a political operation to install Vladimir Putin as president. Satter cited a public opinion poll taken of Putin before the explosions, placing Putin's approval rating at 2% at the time. He further stated that Alexander Aslan, described as the chief sociologist and pollster for the Yeltsin campaign, told a closed meeting of Yeltsin-era leaders that no Yeltsin-connected figure could be elected president through normal means, with Yevgeny Savustyanov, then head of the FSB in Moscow, recalling that unnormal means could be employed. Satter described a fifth bomb, discovered and diffused in a residential building in Ryazan, housing approximately 400 residents, with FSB agents allegedly caught placing the device. He said the timer was set for 5:30 in the morning, and the device included a professional detonator and military-grade explosives. Had it detonated, Satter assessed, casualties beyond the approximately 300 already killed in the four prior bombings would have been in the hundreds. Satter named Sergei Yushchenkov, Yuri S.H. Chekuchikin, Alexander Litvinenko, and Anna Politkovskaya as individuals who investigated the bombings and were subsequently killed. On Litvinenko specifically, Satter noted that an inquest concluded the order to kill him had to have come from Putin. Satter also assessed that Western governments engaged in active concealment, citing then-Secretary of State Madeleine Albright's Senate testimony, in which she declined to attribute responsibility, and British Prime Minister Tony Blair, who Satter said organized what he characterized as probably the most lavish reception for a foreign leader ever organized in Great Britain, for Putin shortly after the bombings, with Russia subsequently joining the G8. It is worth being clear, these are Satter's stated views, advanced as his analytical and journalistic conclusions. The Kremlin's long-standing position attributes the 1999 bombings to Chechen militants, and that position is not represented in the transcript from which this account is drawn. The historical dispute over responsibility for those bombings remains contested and unresolved in open-source international reporting. The convergence of stories this week points to a conflict that is grinding through a phase of attritional exhaustion on the Russian side. Measurable in casualty figures, recruitment shortfalls, demographic drain in the Far East, and elite anxiety inside the Kremlin, while Ukraine presses its long-range strike campaign and its allies navigate a fragile diplomatic environment with U.S. mediation now formally suspended, the energy dimension adds a layer of structural urgency for Europe that will shape policy through the coming winter, regardless of how the front lines move. Thank you for listening. That's your geopolitics briefing for today from Briefing Desk. We'll be back tomorrow with the latest developments.